You're listening to The Big Blow, a brass quartet who used this rather charming arrangement of London Calling by The Clash to publicise their action last Saturday as part of International 350 Day. Their call was for as many brass players as possible to meet them on London's South Bank and to join in an extended drone on the note F, whose frequency is 350 Hz. This was just one of over 5,000 actions taking place around the globe to signal the importance of the number 350 to climate stability and to the future of life on Earth. It's the safe level of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, expressed in parts per million of carbon dioxide or carbon dioxide equivalent, and it's based on the same science by James Hansen and his team that this program is named after. Here's Bill McKibben, founder of the global campaign 350.org, with his reflections on the day.
Today has been almost literally unbelievable. We organized the largest day of political action in the history of the planet. There were 181 nations that took part, 5,200 events. It was all people around the world who speak 400 or 500 different languages, but they all know Arabic numerals, and they were all saying the same thing. 350 means survival for us, and so we got to have it. It's been, in fact, incredibly uplifting, and especially the last couple of days, as if the planet's immune system was kind of kicking in, as if the kind of antibodies that are represented by conscious citizens are beginning to sort of isolate the threat and try to take some action. And it's really important for people to get off their, you know, get out from behind the keyboard and whatever else and take political action. We don't want to hear, you know, instead of lame excuses about how politically difficult it is. Of course it's difficult. It's the hardest thing we've ever tried to do, to get off fossil fuel. But it's nowhere near as hard as the alternative. So I guess the point from today is, you know, it's time for people to man up a little bit. Enough whining about how, you know, the Senate won't let you do whatever. You know, everybody's got to go to work as hard as they can for the next 6 weeks. There's nothing more important on Earth, so we might as well get down to it. For now, all eyes are on Copenhagen, obviously. It's not going to come out perfectly. It's not even going to come out close to perfectly. But it's a forum to press this demand in a serious way. So help us in the next 6 weeks help spread this meme that's now spreading all over the place. And I mean all over the place. If there are 15,000 kids, young people, in the streets of Addis Ababa in Ethiopia chanting 350, then that's a meme that's spread pretty darn far.
You're listening to the 300 to 350 show, the independent climate bulletin made for Resonance FM in London and syndicated to community radio and other independent media around the globe. That was Bill McKibben, founder of the Global 350.org campaign, speaking to Fisk Umbra of the US-based environmental news website Grist. As Bill implied, what we're getting from rich country governments currently is a lot of whining and a bunch of lame excuses, rather than an adequate response based on the science and fairness. The main break on action, generally, seems to be the lobbying of corporate interests. As a general rule, any effective action on climate change is fiercely resisted by the vested interest affected. Business has also promoted and backed emissions trading and cap-and-trade schemes as their preferred solution to climate change. But experience so far has shown this to be largely an elaborate, self-deceiving displacement activity, with alarming parallels to the complex financial derivatives market that has recently wreaked havoc with the global economy. Our predicament is that we are trying to solve the climate crisis at the very same time when rich governments are least keen on applying any regulations to business, no matter how old, dirty, and polluting. We are at the apex of the so-called neoliberal period, where the economic religion of our times tells us that any interference with the economy is a bad thing. Not only are we wary of reining in the most damaging aspects of business practice, we often find a revolving door between business and government. The fox, as they say, has been put in charge of the henhouse. So it's appropriate that there have been actions recently, both in Europe and in the US, to bring attention to the unhealthy influence of corporations on national and international climate policy.
Our climate is not for sale!
That was the sound of activists setting up a blockade yesterday morning at the European Commission's Charlemagne building in Brussels, in advance of the annual conference of the Confederation of European Business. The activists blocked the doors and prevented the 200 delegates from entering for around 2 hours before police used pepper spray to disperse them. Some 25 people were arrested and then discharged. Protesters noted that corporate sponsors of the meeting, including Shell, ArcelorMittal, BASF and Daimler, are all known for their anti-climate lobbying. According to the Climate Justice Action website, activists continued to disrupt the conference later in the day as four singers broke out into an a cappella song, "Our Climate Is Not Your Business," during a speech by the Shell CEO, Graham Sweeney. Three clowns ran after one another with placards saying, "Don't joke with the climate," and "You're just greenwashing." And then four people disrupted the speech by Philippe Dubuc, Director General of Business Europe, by holding a banner and blowing loud whistles. The action also comes as European heads of state meet to finalise what is widely expected to be a scientifically inadequate and unjust negotiating position for Copenhagen. Meanwhile, in the US of A, on the 19th of October, anti-corporate pranksters, the Yes Men, took on the US Chamber of Commerce, first with a press release that got picked up by Reuters and the Fox Business Network.
But a reversal on climate change from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Breaking news right now, the Chamber of Commerce saying it will reverse its position on the climate change bill and wants a carbon tax, if you will, in the Senate bill on climate change. Remember, companies like Exelon and other power producers, primarily those on the nuclear side, left the U.S. Chamber of Commerce because the chamber opposed the climate change bill. Now the chamber reversing its position. The reason that Exelon and others left is they said, well, this may be a tax on business, but we need to know what carbon is worth. They want to have more of a set price. All right, so the U.S. chamber is denying it now. All right, so maybe not. So apparently we just called the Chamber of Commerce, said, can you give us more comment on these headlines that are crossing? And they are denying that they are changing their position on climate change legislation.
Alongside the press release, the Yes Men's Andy Bickelbaum, posing as the fictitious Hingo Sembra, held a press conference where he led unsuspecting reporters into believing that the US Chamber of Commerce had accepted the full reality of climate change and would no longer be campaigning against climate change legislation. Instead, it would throw its lobbying weight into strengthening action on climate change by supporting the introduction of a carbon tax rather than a cap-and-trade system. But by the time the session got round to questions and answers, the Yes Men had been rumbled. Here's Eric Volschlegel of the real US Chamber of Commerce storming the room.
This guy is a fraud. He's lying. This is, you know, a stunt that I've never seen before.
And we know you're not.
This is the stunt.
So, does this mean that the Chamber of Commerce does not endorse, it is not acknowledging the climate change?
Whatever this gentleman here said to you today is irrelevant. It's not factual. This is a fraudulent press conference. Okay? He's misrepresenting the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
So what is the position then? It has not changed. That it is going to continue to be that there is no climate change. Is that correct?
I'm here to tell you that this is not a formal press conference by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Yes, you, I have
we did. We
you.
Did hold a press conference last week with President Donahue of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Right,
if you'd like to get our position.
Have for you.
No, I'm with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Do you have a
Yeah, I do. So if you'd like to actually talk to the legitimate Chamber of Commerce, I've got my business cards outside. This gentleman, I will assure you, does not have any business cards, and he's not legitimate.
Here's Andy Bickelbaum of the Yes Men explaining the motivation behind the action to Amy Goodman of Democracy Now!
One day after his latest hoax, the Yes Men's Andy Bickelbaum joins us now from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Andy. What about the statement of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that you, in fact, are getting in the way of responsible, constructive dialogue about global warming?
Well, the only thing getting in the way here is the chamber's absolutely troglodytic backwards stance on global warming. The entire rest of the world is ahead of them, including our own government, our own Department of Energy, and even a number of the chamber's own biggest members and branches have left the chamber over this ridiculous stance that they're taking, that we don't need climate legislation. They're not backing the Kerry-Boxer bill, and not because it's weak, but because they don't want climate legislation. They don't want science interfering with business, and that's about as stupid a position as you could have. It's like the most backwards of corporate America.
And I just want to read to you, Andy, some of the lobbying numbers, the amount of money that the chamber has spent lobbying Congress. Mm. The third quarter lobbying expenditures were just released a few days ago. They tallied to a jaw-dropping $34.7 million. That record-breaking amount translates into more than $300,000 in lobbying per day.
And the request by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce for law enforcement to get involved here to investigate what you did?
Well, we welcome that. The more we can get them to pay attention to what we do, the more we get our message out, which is that their stance is ridiculous. And I think most people looking at their stance will get that as the one-line takeaway. To deny the importance of climate legislation is stupid, suicidal, and actually murderous. They're putting us all on the line. And the risk, the minor risk that we took by doing this, which, you know, could result, who knows, maybe they'll, you know, unlike any of our other targets, they'll figure out how to get us in trouble. That risk is tiny compared to the certainty of what we're facing if we don't do anything about it. And, you know, we co-organized this. We got a lot of help organizing this from a group of direct action activists at beyondtalk.net. I heard the previous speaker talking about mobilizeforhealthcare.org, getting people to perform civil disobedience around climate, around healthcare. Beyondtalk.net similarly tries to get people to pledge to perform direct actions, arrestable direct actions around climate change. It's really come to that. More and more people are doing this, and we need to take risks, in this case, negligible risks, in order to get this issue on the agenda and really put pressure on portions of the public sphere that need the pressure put on them.
As its contribution to global efforts on climate change, the US is saying that it will cut its emissions by just 2-4% by 2020 compared to 1990 levels. But the science suggests that rich countries should be cutting their own emissions by around 40%. Several weeks ago on this programme, we looked at some of the things the US could do if it wanted to scale up its action on climate change and help secure a global deal that was effective and fair. One important thing to note is that US carbon emissions have dropped by around 9% in the last 2 years, for a variety of reasons, so there is already a strong base to build on. Another important building block is the existing authority that the President and the Environmental Protection Agency already has under the Clean Air Act to regulate coal-fired power plants directly. And shortly after that program was broadcast, that authority was indeed revived in the US. Here's Jonathan Pershing, head of the US delegation at the UN climate talks, flagging this up as significant in a press conference in Bali a few weeks ago.
At home, we have an impressive array of measures that President Obama has put in place in the 8 short months that he's been in office. And let me just refer to several new things that have happened only in the time that I've been here in Bangkok. The Environmental Protection Agency announced that it will work toward regulating emissions from stationary sources that emit at least 25,000 tons of carbon dioxide a year. These sources include a very substantial share of all the power plants that generate U.S. electricity.
This revived authority of the EPA to regulate coal-fired power stations directly has also come under strong attack by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Here's an edited extract from Daphne Wysham's Earthbeat radio program, where she looks at whether this proposal is for real or whether it's just a pawn in the game to get climate legislation passed in the U.S. Congress.
The Environmental Protection Agency announced it was moving forward on new rules to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from hundreds of large emitters. On exactly the same day as Democratic Senators Barbara Boxer of California and John Kerry from Massachusetts announced their response to the Waxman-Markey climate bill. Do the two actions go hand in hand, or is this a game of political hot potato? And so, Mike Livermore, what exactly did the EPA announce it was going to do on Wednesday of last week?
Obviously, the Supreme Court has clarified that EPA does have authority to regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act. And what EPA did is basically announce its intention to go forward with regulations and clarified that it's going to be targeting the biggest emitters of greenhouse gases rather than trying to regulate every tiny small source.
So, Bill, was this announcement a way for the Obama administration to put Congress on notice that if it doesn't take action on climate change, Obama will take the reins?
I think that's absolutely what it was. It was probably more a political gesture than it was a legal gesture. Remember, this is only a proposed rule. They still have to finalize it after much public and comment. And I think the administration would very much like Congress to act as opposed to them unilaterally.
But you've produced a paper, correct, that suggests that there is plenty of room to move forward under EPA authority alone without the actions of Congress. Can you explain exactly how that would look?
Exactly. Well, the Clean Air Act is a very successful statute. It's been around for 40 years. It has reduced all sorts of different air pollutants from lead to carbon monoxide. Here, with greenhouse gases such as carbon dioxide, it would certainly be a challenge, but the infrastructure is in place at both the federal and state governments to make this work. We think existing authority would do the job quite well. And in fact, we think existing authority would be better than a bad piece of legislation.
And how quickly would we be able to see significant cuts in greenhouse gas emissions? Because one of the arguments against EPA authority that we often hear is, well, there will be just lawsuit after lawsuit and nothing will get done for years, and therefore legislation is a much speedier approach to take.
I think that's a good question. I think there'll be delays under both approach. There'll be lawsuits under any new congressional legislation. There'll be lawsuits under an administrative action. There are certain entrenched interests that will file lawsuits against good things on global warming no matter what. I think EPA could move relatively quickly. And certainly if you compare what EPA has under its authority compared with the House bill, which we thought was very weak, we think EPA would get the job done much more quickly than with the House bill.
Now, the Senate version of climate change legislation currently doesn't limit the EPA's authority, but in a press conference after releasing the bill, Senator Kerry said limiting the EPA's authority was still on the table. Now, Bill, why do you think Senator Kerry would make such a statement? What is he doing there?
Well, he's clearly sending signals that he wants to negotiate to get to 60. That is the magic number to avoid a filibuster and pass the bill. We were disappointed, however, with those statements, and we hope that the Clean Air Act provisions do stay in the Senate bill, that the Clean Air Act still can work under the Senate bill, because it's a great backstop. It's a way to make sure that no matter what, we're reducing pollution.
Mike Livermore, you've touched on the fact that neither of these actions, either EPA authority or Congress, alone will do enough to slow the pace of global warming. Is there a way, for example, say we had legislative authority to move forward and we have the regulatory authority as part of the package, could we, for example, next year make coal plants illegal? Could we shut them down? Or is that even on the table? Is that part of the package?
I mean, I certainly don't think it's on the table from a political perspective, certainly within that time frame. you know, I mean, Congress is pretty broad authority, and coal-fired power plants are pretty bad, both for greenhouse gas reasons and for other pollutants that they put out. But coal states are very powerful. The coal industry has a lot of influence, and that's not just in Congress. I would be just floored if the Obama administration moved forward with a rule like that. That having been said, ultimately, I think, you know, either, you know, folks have hopes for carbon capture and storage. If that doesn't pan out, we're either going to have to stop using coal or, you know, we're just going to basically not do anything about climate change, because ultimately you have to deal with the problem of coal to deal with climate change.
These proposed rules by the Environmental Protection Agency could take effect in 2 years and require 400 power plants around the country to prove that they're using the so-called best available control technology to limit emissions. Bill, can you tell us, does this mean that coal power plants and nuclear power plants will be held to a different emission standard because coal inherently produces far more CO2 than nuclear? Or what's going to be taking place there with these new rules in the next couple of years?
Well, administratively, EPA does have a lot of flexibility, so they will have different standards and different rules for different industries. So the nuclear industry would have a set of different standards, technical standards, than does the coal industry. However, I think there's an overarching standard issue that I want to address, which is that both the House bill and the Senate bill, and in fact, even EPA itself so far, doesn't appear to be addressing the ultimate scientific standard, which is our carbon dioxide levels right now at about 390 parts per million is higher already than what the best available science tells us we need to go. And under current growth projections, we're going to be well above what the best available science says. So we're already in deep water here.
Talk about that a little bit, because we've had, the science keeps surpassing the worst case scenarios that they imagine.
Absolutely. And just as a quick background, you know, several years ago, 450 million parts per million was deemed to be a safe target, and that's what the United Nations set as its target. Mm-hmm. Well, as the years and months have gone on, including just recently, as you alluded to, the number has been reduced to about 350 parts per million. And in fact, that's probably itself could go lower. Both the House and Senate bill have targets that are far above that when you extrapolate out through with other countries. It's a significant problem.
So I guess the question is, are either EPA regulations or the Senate bill or the House bill really taking into consideration all of these changes? Are they moving at such a glacial pace when glaciers are melting literally around the world?
No, I think the political response so far has been timid at best. In my 20 years of doing this type of work, I've never seen the scientists more shrill than the advocates themselves. The scientists who are studying this problem are extremely alarmed at what is happening. And there's this tipping point phenomenon in the Arctic you mentioned, mm-hmm. where it is melting. If the Arctic continues to melt at its current rate, it's going to release more methane, which is 20 times more powerful than carbon dioxide, which will start a whole new round of warming. So we are messing with the planet's ecosystems and biosphere in a way that we can't even imagine, and it really is scary.
So do you see this as just sort of a big program of giving away gifts to just about every industry that might put up opposition as a way of getting a bill through? Is that what's going on?
That's certainly our analysis. And when you look at the House bill specifically, if I were a representative of the coal industry, I'd think it was a great deal. I mean, the billions of dollars that are going to go into this carbon sequestration, a completely unproven technology in many mm-hmm. respects, and has a whole series of problems itself. I mean, it's astonishing. So, to even get these very modest reductions in pollution, we are giving away a lot.
I mean, I think that you allude to the political situation, which is dire. I mean, it's very hard to get anything done in the U.S. It's extremely hard to get anything done good in Congress. It's extremely hard to get things through the regulatory process, and we are up against a wall with climate change tipping points. And so, you know, absent some kind of broad-based political movement that's going to arise in the next couple of months, I think the best we can hope for is kind of strong statements from the Obama administration, then we'll go with that into Copenhagen.
Bill Snape, what's your view on the next couple of months?
Well, I agree with Mike. I think it will be largely rhetorical over the course of the next 2 months. I want to make the point, however, that all this moaning and groaning about economic costs, which we take seriously. It's not as though that's a trivial point. I think you have to compare that with the cost of inaction. The costs of inaction, I believe, are far more perilous for our society, both in the United States and globally, than the supposed loss of jobs and costs that some of the economists are dragging up. So the cost of inaction to us is huge.
That was Daphne Wysham, host of Earthbeat Radio, with Mike Livermore, the executive director of the Institute for Policy Integrity at New York's University School of Law, and Bill Snape, the senior counsel for the Center for Biological Diversity. If we want to stop runaway climate change, then we're rapidly running out of time. And yet we're clearly not doing everything we can. In the UK, for example, you might recall that 24 Greenpeace activists slept out overnight on the roof of the Houses of Parliament the night before Parliament reconvened. This action was to flag up the need for real action on climate change, and a 12-point plan of action by Greenpeace director John Sovan for things that we should be doing straight away. The Stop Climate Chaos Coalition of Environment and Development NGOs, with a combined membership of 11 million people, has its own list of asks from the government that would help bring down emissions by 40% in the UK by 2020. Just last week, the government voted against a Liberal Democrat motion supported by the Conservatives to support the 10-10 campaign and reduce emissions in government buildings by 10% by the end of next year. The Independent Committee on Climate Change, established by the Climate Change Act, continues to call for a step change in government action, including a mass rollout of insulation for homes and greenhouse gas standards for electricity generation that would rule out coal without full carbon capture and storage. And the Campaign Against Climate Change has an ongoing campaign for the government to institute policies immediately that reduce our greenhouse gases across the whole of the UK. Colin Challen MP has just put forward an early day motion in the House of Commons, number 2075, which supports the key demands of this campaign. Isn't it time we took corporate interests out of climate policy and just got on with what we need to do? What would the Copenhagen deal look like if we just got on with doing the right thing? We end this week's programme with a video message from 6 10-year-olds to world leaders made by the Age of Stupid team. Do visit the permanent archives of these programmes at www.climateradio.org, where you can also get a full set of references for these shows. Till next week, thanks for listening.
Or 60, but I'm 9.
I'm 10.
10.
11.
9.
11.
So we will be your age around 2050 or 2060. By then, the world could be totally different.
The temperature could be much hotter, with floods, droughts, famines, and even wars.
Millions of people can lose their homes.
Millions of people could die.
Maybe even billions.
Maybe even everybody.
In this room right here in December, you will decide if that is our future or whether we have a safe world to live in.
At the moment, you are choosing the nightmare.
You say that it's not possible to cut emissions fast enough.
You say that protecting business is more important than protecting the world.
You always blame each other.
It's America's fault.
It's Australia's fault.
It's China's fault.
Some of you even say that climate change isn't happening.
But it is still possible.
There is still time.
You could be the heroes that save everybody.
Or you can be the useless politicians who make the biggest mistake ever.
So please come here to Copenhagen and...
Don't be